is good for you over to what makes you feel good. Wait, not heroin. Heroin is not your happy place. Just cross all drugs off the list. Are we clear? Okay, find a good happy place, a positive one. I have shifted my priorities. My job is still incredibly important. It's just that playing with my kids is now more important than my job. In case the idea of doing this makes you nervous, makes you anxious, freaks you out, makes you think I'm an idiot, you might say, "That's all very nice for you, Shonda. You're the boss at your job, but I am a cashier, so please tell me how I can turn my back on my job and still feed my family, stupid TV lady with your lace shoes and your diamonds. I hope your tiara squeezes your brains right out of your head." I agree with you. Whitney Houston, Curling Iron, Solidarity. But here's the thing that I hope helps. Here's the thing that I learned very quickly. Nobody wants to spend that much time with me or with you. You know why? You aren't Taylor Swift or Curious George or Rihanna or the Muppets. I mean that in a good way, a great way. I mean that you can do this. I mean that no matter how busy you are, how hectic your life is, you can probably pull this off in some way. Emerson and Beckett only ever want to play with me for 15 minutes or so before they lose interest and want to go do something else. It's an amazing 15 minutes. But it's 15 minutes. After 15 minutes, I'm no one. If I'm not a grasshopper in the yard or a popsicle or the very hungry caterpillar, I may as well be a tree. Most of the time, Harper only ever wants to talk to me for 15 minutes as well, sometimes less. I can pull off 15 minutes. I can totally pull off 15 minutes of uninterrupted time, even on my worst day. Uninterrupted is the key. No cell phone, no laundry, no dinner, no anything. You have a busy life. You have to get dinner on the table. You have to make sure they get homework done. You have to force them to bathe. But you can do 15 minutes. While I was shocked to discover how little time this yes-to-play commitment really took and how easy it was to incorporate into my daily life, it was about more than this. What was most difficult was what it forced me to face about myself. I discovered that age-old cliche is true. People do what they like to do. I work because I like working. I am good at it. It works for me. It's my comfort zone. Knowing, facing the fact that I was more comfortable on a sound stage than on a swing set was incredibly difficult to handle. What kind of person is more comfortable working than relaxing? Well, me. So this yes required me to change. It's a difficult challenge for a hardworking, straight-A, obsessive perfectionist to leap into a lifestyle practice that requires dropping everything to play. As I've said, my earliest memories were of imagining in the pantry. As I got older, I preferred the library to any other play space, the books inside to any other companion. When forced outdoors for fresh air and sunshine, I grabbed a book and stuffed it down the back of my pants to hide my contraband. Then I'd climb the willow tree in our backyard and read until my mother allowed me back in. Playing? I don't remember any real playing. My nanny, Jenny McCarthy, watches all this unfold with solemn eyes. She watches me drop my bags and gets out on the floor, awkward and stiff. She offers suggestions. "You should play with the blocks. What if you all did some painting?" Jenny McCarthy is quietly guiding me, teaching me how to play, teaching the stiff, introverted workaholic in me what play means for those outside the pantry doors, outside the library shelves. She's teaching me how to reach and connect with these little extroverts so different from me. I feel like some kind of alien, never before on this planet, learning what this world is like. Jenny McCarthy is showing me how to live. Through these tiny karmic beings sent by the universe to help roll the rock away from the door of my cave and shove me into that bright, beautiful sun. And I am grateful. We run around the yard, up and back and up and back. We have 30-second dance parties in the kitchen. We sing show tunes. We play with baby dolls and hand puppets and Fisher-Price Farms. It's the bubbles that do it. I'm sitting in the backyard blowing an endless series of bubbles for the girls. The bubbles are filling the air. I'm on a roll, blowing as fast as I can to create a sea of bubbles all around their faces. They are squealing, popping bubbles and tasting bubbles and chasing bubbles. Beckett runs over and presses her sweaty body into me. She has that slight, musky, dirty kid smell. It always smells to me like, "You smell like puppies," I tell them. And suddenly a painting is hung back on my wall. My mother's in the backyard tending to her big round roses. The sun has just gone down. And my sister Sandy and I are racing around the backyard, each with a glass mason jar, trying to catch fireflies, squealing and chasing fireflies, catching them, staring at them, our faces glowing in their light. Then just when my mother calls for bedtime, we open the jars and release them into the night air. "You smell like puppies," my mother laughs as she shoos us inside. So now my memory stands corrected. I used to play when I was this age. I played. I was happy. I liked it. I smelled like puppies. I was a puppy party. I played. I don't know why I ever stopped. I suddenly find that I start asking myself the same question that the children ask me. Wanna play? Yes. Yes, I do. But in order to do so, I know I have to make some real changes. I make a rule that I will not work on Saturday or Sunday unless it's an emergency or unless the show is filming. I've been guilty of working straight through far too many weekends in order to get ahead. There's no such thing. The work is always there in the morning. I change the bottom of my email signature so that it now reads, "Please note, I will not engage in work emails after 7 p.m. or on weekends. If I am your boss, may I suggest, put down your phone." And then I do what seems impossible. I actually stop answering emails that arrive after 7 p.m. I have to turn off my phone to do it, but I do it. I have incredibly expert people working for me who run our sets. Learning to step back and let these people have the pleasure of doing their jobs without my peering over their shoulders has been great for them and for me both. I make a vow to come home by 6 p.m. every night for dinner. If an issue is happening at work, I can find a way to come home from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. to be with the kids and then hop on my computer and work from home after that. Technology should be making it easier and easier for this to happen. I am not perfect at it. In fact, I fail as often as I succeed. But what I know now is that this downtime is helping me to relight that little spark inside. It's helping my creativity. And in the long run, helping me tell the stories my work needs me to tell. I give myself permission to view this downtime as essential. It's hard to do. It's hard to feel like I deserve any time to replenish the well when I know everyone else is working hard too. Except once again, there's Dolores in my kitchen. "Shonda, what happens when you get sick? What happened that time you threw your back out, that time you had the flu?" We don't like to talk about it at work. It's like tempting fate. But Dolores means when I go down, the shows go down. If I go down, eventually things in Shondaland come to a halt. Because of that track laying that has to happen. Stories originate with my brain, and if they can't come out of my brain, no one can even begin to lay track. And if the track can't be laid, the train cannot roll. It's the same with Kerry Washington, Viola Davis, Ellen Pompeo. If one of them goes down, so goes a show. The cameras can't roll without them. It makes it incredibly essential to keep in good shape. Ellen, who seems to have more stamina and determination than anyone I've ever seen, once said that making 24 episodes of network television is like running a marathon 24 times. Since season one, she has treated herself like an athlete in training. Ellen believes that to do her job well, she needs to take care of herself, inside and out. Ellen's approach becomes my inspiration. I decide maybe it's time I started thinking the same way about my job. For me, that means if track is going to be laid, I need some time to play. Want to play? Home by 6, no phones after 7, try not to work weekends. Then I expand it. Want to play? I use it as a way of allowing myself to seek comforts I would not normally allow. Want to play starts to become a shorthand for indulging myself in ways I'd forgotten about. Manicures? Pedicures? Want to play? Yes. Browse for hours in an actual bookstore on a Saturday afternoon when the kids are on a play date? Want to play? Yes. A long bath with some Aretha Franklin blaring loud enough that no one can hear me singing? Want to play? Hell yes. A glass of wine and a square of chocolate and 15 minutes of guiltless silence with my door closed? Want to play? Please keep your voice down, but yes. 15 minutes, I say. What could be wrong with giving myself my full attention for just 15 minutes? Turns out, nothing. The more I play, the happier I am at work. The happier I am at work, the more relaxed I become. The more relaxed I become, the happier I am at home. And the better I get at the playtime I have with the kids. It's really just love. We could all use a little more love. A lot more love. For the kids. For me. This is the best yes. Want to play? Chapter 8. Yes to My Body. Here's the thing I maybe forgot to mention. When I decide to begin my year of yes, that night I decide I'm going to start saying yes to the things that scare me. That night I told you about when I'm lying on the sofa with a glass of wine staring at my Christmas tree. I am fat. I'm not cutely chubby or nicely plus size. I'm not round in my rump. I don't have junk in my trunk. I'm not voluptuous. I'm not going pa-pow and ba-bam in all the right places. I'm not working my curves the way I did in college. If I was, you can bet I would be wearing something cute and tight and daring you to say something about it. But that is not what is going on. No. I am fat. I am obese. I am the biggest I have ever been in my entire life. I am so fat that I am uncomfortable in my own skin. So fat that I am having the surreal experience of catching a glimpse of myself in the mirror and wondering with genuine confusion, who is that? It actually takes a few seconds for my brain to catch up, for me to realize with shock that I am looking at my own reflection. That stranger is me. I am staring at myself encased in many, many extra pounds of fat. So many I'm afraid to get on a scale. I am massive. But that's not the thing. I am massive. But more important, I feel massive, which is the thing. Look, I will not be told what size to be. I do not care about anyone else's judgment about my body. I am not interested in anyone else's ideas of what I'm supposed to look like. I believe everybody's body is theirs, and everyone has a right to love their body in whatever size and shape and package it comes in. I will fight for anyone's right to do so. I will kick ass and take names if I have to. Your body is yours. My body is mine. No one's body is up for comment. No matter how small, how large, how curvy, how flat, if you love you, then I love you. But this is not about loving me. I don't feel good. And while part of me means it emotionally, I mostly mean it physically. I don't feel good. My knees hurt. My joints hurt. I discover that the reason I'm so exhausted all the time is because I have sleep apnea. I am now on high blood pressure medication. I can't get comfortable. I can't touch my toes. My toes are untouchable. I need to eat a piece of cake to cope with this discovery. I am a mess. I do not know how this happened. Except I do. Remember that genetic Powerball lottery the women in my family have won? The one that means we will never look older than a pack of terribly tired teenagers? It seems there's also a metabolic super lotto that had the winning numbers, but only for half the women in my family. So my sisters Dolores and Sandy have the great luck of not only looking 14 years old, but also being able to eat half a cow in one sitting and never look larger than, well, a 14-year-old. I, on the other hand, did not draw those numbers. Fat runs toward me and jumps up onto my body and clings there, like it knows it has found a home, like it wants to be with its people. I've battled my weight my entire life. It always seemed unfair. It was always a horrible struggle. And after a while, I decided that struggling was not worth it. So I stopped battling. I stopped starving myself. And I settled in at what seemed like a not too heavy but not skinny weight. Plus size. Juicy. Curvy. Definitely cute. Great booty. I was healthy. I was working out. I wasn't thinking too much about my body anyway. And then I lost control of the wheel. Don't ask me exactly when. I'm not sure. But I know it coincided with my slowly closing all the doors of my life, saying no to things, shutting down. And here's the thing. It didn't really feel like that was what was happening. I mean, I had a lot going on. I had some excellent excuses for letting go of that wheel. I decided to freeze my eggs, like the ones inside my body. Babies. Yes, the miracle of life. In order to freeze your eggs, you have to inject yourself with some hormones. Now, if you are a naturally thin person, you seem to stay thin. If you are me, not so much. Then out of nowhere, I had a minor surgery, which made me go, I better stop all this working out and maybe lie down here on this sofa for a bit to recuperate. The surgery was on my eye. So, what's your point? It doesn't matter that the surgery was on my eye. My eye needed to recuperate. But when my eye was better, that sofa kind of needed me. It didn't seem that important to get back up. Plus, there was some good TV on. Oh, yes, TV. I had a job, Grey's Anatomy. Then I had two jobs. I added private practice. Then I had three jobs. I added Scandal on top of those shows. And then, just as I said goodbye to private practice, we began producing How to Get Away with Murder. And the more shows I had, the more I could be found at my desk or on a sofa in an editing room. The more I could be found sitting on my butt. The more I sat, the less I moved. The less I moved, don't make me say it. And the shows were doing so well, which was like some kind of cruel joke. If something had failed, the irony was that I would have had time to take myself to the gym. I would have had time to get some rest. I would have had time to take care of myself. At least that's the story I told myself. But nothing got canceled. I was succeeding. I was doing more than succeeding. It's incredibly rare for a television drama to run even three seasons, and by this point, the shows I'd created had all gone at least five. Shondaland was a brand now. The studio expected us to produce more shows. The network expected me to maintain the quality of the ones currently on the air. Now I owned an entire night of the most expensive real estate on television. TGIT had taken over social media. Everyone around me seemed invested. Very invested. I started having nightmares about getting canceled. Dolores and Jenny McCarthy fussed over me, worrying that my creativity would be affected by stress. They didn't understand. My creativity was the one place I never felt stress. Creating worlds, characters, stories has always been the place where I am most at ease. With the empty whiteboard of an episode before me, I slip into a zone of calm confidence. I feel the hum. Making television for me is blissful. I can make stuff up the way other people can sing. I have simply always been able to hit all the notes. At its core, a TV show is just a bigger pantry. So I wasn't worried about writing the shows or making the shows. I was worried about rising expectations. I was worried about the stakes. Oh, yeah. Maybe I should mention there are stakes, and man, oh, man, are they high. As the shows got more popular, I was acutely, painfully aware of what was at stake. I smiled, refused to answer the question, pretended I didn't know what reporters were asking me about when they asked about race. But you can't be raised black in America and not know. This wasn't just my shot. It was ours. I had to do everything right. I had to keep it all afloat. I had to run to the top of the mountain. I could not rest. I could not fall. I could not stumble. I could not quit. Failing to reach the summit was not an option. Failing would be bigger than just me. Blowing it would reverberate for decades to come. With Grey's Anatomy, it would mean that giving an African-American woman her own show with a cast that looked like the real world was a mistake. I proved it wasn't. The stakes got even higher for Scandal. If the first network drama with an African-American leading lady in 37 years didn't find an audience, who knows how long it would take for another to come along? Failure meant two generations of actresses might have to wait for another chance to be seen as more than a sidekick. I am what I have come to call an FOD, a first, only, different. We are a very select club, but there are more of us out there than you'd think. We know one another on sight. We all have that same weary look in our eyes. The one that wishes people would stop thinking it remarkable that we can be great at what we do while black, while Asian, while a woman, while Latino, while gay, while a paraplegic, while deaf. But when you are an FOD, you are saddled with that burden of extra responsibility, whether you want it or not. When I made my first television show, I did something I felt was perfectly normal. In the 21st century, I made the world of the show look the way the world looks. I filled it with people of all hues, genders, backgrounds, and sexual orientations. And then I did the most obvious thing possible. I wrote all of them as if they were people. People of color live three-dimensional lives, have love stories, and are not funny sidekicks, cliches, or criminals. Women are the heroes, the villains, the badasses, the big dogs. This, I was told over and over, was trailblazing and brave. I hope you have your left eyebrow raised too, dear reader. Because girl, please. But I was doing a thing that the suits had said could not be done on TV. And America was proving them wrong by watching. We were literally changing the face of television. I was not about to make a mistake now. You don't get second chances. Not when you're an FOD. Second chances are for future generations. That is what you are building when you are an FOD. Second chances are for the ones who come behind you. As Papa Pope told his daughter Olivia, you have to be twice as good to get half as much. I didn't want half. I wanted it all. And so I worked four times as hard. I never wanted to have to look at myself in the mirror and say I didn't try as hard as I could to make these shows work. That I didn't give 100% to leave a legacy for my daughters and for all the young women of color out there who wondered what was possible. It irritated me to my core that we live in an era of ignorance great enough that it was still necessary for me to be a role model. But that didn't change the fact that I was one. I got into the habit of working as hard as I could all the time. My life revolved around work. And outside of work, I took the path of least resistance. I didn't have the energy for difficult conversations or arguments, so I smiled and let people get away with treating me however they wanted. And that only made me yearn to be back in the office, where I was in charge, where I was the boss, where people were too respectful or kind or happy or afraid to treat me like crap. Because I worked so much, I found myself constantly tired. In the early days of Grey's, I said no to so many invitations that people actually stopped asking me. I began to have a reputation as someone who did not socialize with work people outside of work. In reality, I didn't socialize with anyone outside of work. My larger circle of friends also didn't understand. There were whispers I'd abandoned them for a glamorous Hollywood life filled with parties and famous friends. I would have laughed at this, but I was just too tired. I'd get an angry email about a missed birthday and would be asleep face first on my keyboard before I could craft an apologetic response. Finally, I just gave up. My friends self-selected down to a smaller core group. I stayed home more and spent more time working, more time alone, more time hiding. Losing yourself does not happen all at once. Losing yourself happens one no at a time. No to going out tonight. No to catching up with that old college roommate. No to attending that party. No to going on a vacation. No to making a new friend. Losing yourself happens 1 pound at a time. The more I worked, the more stressed I was. The more stressed I was, the more I ate. I knew things were getting out of hand. As I started to feel more uncomfortable, as I started to feel more tired, as the jeans got tighter and tighter. When I went up size after size, when I needed the largest size clothing in the plus size shop. And yet, I was ambivalent about so much of it. The feminist in me didn't want to have the discussion with myself. I resented the need to talk about weight. It felt as though I was judging myself on how I looked. It felt shallow. It felt misogynistic. It felt traitorous to care. My body is just the container I carry my brain around in. I started saying that back in college when the frat guys would make dirty comments about my boobs. And I used this tone that said, God, how dumb are you? But I had to say it to them a lot. To make them know I should be invisible to them. To make them stop looking. And now I was saying it to myself a lot. To make me invisible to myself. My body is just a container I carry my brain around in. I said it while I ate cartons of ice cream. I said it while I ate whole pizzas. I said it while I enjoyed mac and cheese with bacon in it. You heard me. Bacon in it. I ate anything that had bacon in it or was wrapped in bacon. One meat wrapped in another meat clearly proved the universe was unfolding exactly as it should. My body is just a container full of bacon that I carry my brain around in. And maybe it is. Maybe it is just a container I carry my brain around in. But so is a car. And if the car is broken down and busted, my brain isn't going anywhere. Same goes for my container. I felt old. Not, I'm old and I like to lie, old. Old. Stop participating in the world, old. Sit in a chair and watch the world go by, old. What an extraordinary waste of a life. But what a tasty human veal. I think no one is noticing. I think no one sees. I think the fact that I have doubled in size may not be that noticeable. Because I don't really notice it. It's happened so gradually. I am invisible to myself. I think I am maybe invisible to everyone. I am not. People tried to be tactfully helpful. People said things to me like, endorphins make you feel good. So does chocolate cake, fool. Betsy Beers, whom I love and adore and would honestly slay a dragon for, or at least kill a spider for, once said, you just have to train yourself to love salads. I did not speak to her for several days. Who trains themselves to love salads? What kind of sicko trains themselves to love salads? I could also train myself to love the taste of gravel or cow crap, but why? I don't hate myself. I hired a trainer, and then I promptly fired him because he said, nothing tastes as good as thin feels. He clichéd at me. He clichéd at me in a perky, condescending tone. Nothing tastes as good as thin feels. Who says that to a fat woman? Seriously, who says that? Because clearly, A, you have never had barbecued ribs, and B, shut your stupid mouth. Being tasty veal is not something I'm happy about. Even Veal does not want to be Veal. Veal wants to be rescued by PETA. I start to long to be rescued as well. I get on a plane to New York. I'm a fancy TV writer, so I have a first-class ticket, a big first-class comfy seat. I settle in, shoes off, pull out my book, grab the seatbelt, and, well, it's got to be broken. It's broken, right? I have a broken seatbelt, right? Right? I do not have a broken seatbelt. I am literally too fat for a first-class airplane seatbelt. I am Violet Beauregard blowing up like a giant blueberry in Willy Wonka's factory. I am the thing that ate Gilbert's grape. Poke me with a pin and I'm going to pop like a balloon. I freaking wish. At least it would mean I wouldn't be a passenger on this plane. The humiliation is starting to make me sweat. A sweaty Shonda is not a pretty Shonda. A sweaty Shonda is a short leap away from a hideous troll-like Shonda. I decide that I have two choices. I can ask the flight attendant for the seatbelt extender, or I can go without a seatbelt, thus ensuring that karma will crash the plane and I will plummet to my death, taking hundreds of innocent seatbelt-wearing, law-abiding people with me. You know me pretty well by now, gentle reader. What do you think I do? Do you think I act like an adult, like a grown-ass woman who ate herself here? Do I hit that button to summon the flight attendant? Do I speak to the flight attendant in a clear and calm voice, carefully enunciating each word so that everyone in the first-class cabin is sure to hear what the sweaty girl in seat 5A has to say? Excuse me, but it has come to my attention that I am now way too fat for this big, giant first-class airplane seatbelt. May I please have the very same seatbelt extender that I used to smirk to myself about while thinking superior thoughts? May I, please? Really? Me? Please. No. You know me by now. You know I don't do that. I choose death. I choose death by fat and by karma, and because Catholicism don't quit, I bravely choose to deal with the hellfire and damnation that will follow forever after as punishment for taking the rest of the plane's passengers down with me. I toss my sweater over my lap to hide the lack of seatbelt, give an apologetic smile to the man in the suit across the aisle, shut my eyes tight, and wait for the painful death that is to come. I don't die. I'm not dead. Hot damn, I'm a narcissist. Did I seriously expect karma to take down a whole plane load of people because my ass got too fat and my ego got too big to admit it? I'm alive. But I immediately start to imagine myself dead. Imagine myself being embalmed. Imagine myself being worked on in a funeral home, some lady putting makeup on my dead fat face. I think of the extra large coffin, the enormous tent my sisters will have to buy to give the funeral director to dress me in. It sounds funny. Not to me. Nothing about this is funny to me. I have two toddlers and a 12-year-old. What the hell have I been doing to myself? I find myself wondering, how do I yes this one? The year of yes, I realize, has become a snowball rolling down a hill. Each yes rolls into the next, and the snowball is growing and growing and growing. Every yes changes something in me. Every yes is a bit more transformative. Every yes sparks some new phase of evolution. So what is the yes here? What do I say yes to in order to get healthy? At first, I don't know. A few days later, I'm lying in bed back at home in the midst of a rousing session of veal practice, watching old Dr. Who reruns, eating chocolate chip cookies and enjoying the raft that is my mattress when it hits me. I like this. The bed, the warm chocolate chip cookies, the veal practice, the warm chocolate chip cookies, the TV, the warm chocolate chip cookies. I like it. No. I love it. I'm enjoying myself. This is fun. It's easy. It's relaxing. It requires very little effort. Plus, did I mention the warm chocolate chip cookies? This is a good time for me. It's a picnic. It's a party. It's a party. This is how I roll. Wait. Oh. And holy crap, there it is. I've already been saying yes. I have been saying yes to being fat. Which is why I'm now so fat. I'm not a failure. I'm successfully fat. I didn't let go of the wheel. I just turned the car down the fat road. I've been saying yes to fatness. And you know what? Why the hell wouldn't I? Being fat has been easier for me. It has worked for me. I wouldn't have done it if it didn't. Being fat made me happy. On Private Practice, Naomi has the following discussion with Addison about putting food on top of feelings to make everything better. Naomi, I take all these feelings, the rage, the exhaustion, the sexual frustration, the desire to run Sam down with my car, the fact that my child now thinks her father is the good parent. I just take it all and I shove it down as far as it'll go, and then I just put some food on top of it. Addison, maybe you should talk to Sam instead of inhaling 4,000 calories a day. Naomi, you know what? You find your magic your way, I'll find my magic mine. I was finding my magic my way. My own special formula involved red wine and buttered popcorn and warm chocolate cake and anything that was fried and 5 cheese macaroni and cheese and veal practice. Did I tell you what veal practice is? Oh, veal practice involved me lying very still on the sofa trying as hard as I could to mimic the life of a veal. While eating veal. I wish I were kidding. It was magic. The food created a nice top coat. It helped smooth down the ragged bits, sealed off the parts of me that were broken. It filled in all the holes, covered up the cracks. Yep, I just put some food on top of any and everything that bothered me. The food just spackled right on in there. And presto, underneath the food, everything inside me was smooth and cold and numb. I was dead inside, and that was good. Magic. Don't ever let anyone tell you that food doesn't work. Anyone who tells you that food doesn't work is either stupid or a liar or has never had food before. You can tell them I said so. It works. Putting food on top of it works. If food did not work, if it didn't work, it's slutty, gluttonous, more is more magic. Everyone in America would be Angelina Jolie thin. No one would drive through. No one would sprinkles or pinkberry or any of it. No. Food does work. Food feels so good when you put it on top of all the stuff you don't want to deal with or know how to deal with. It even works on stuff you don't even recognize as worthy of dealing with. Food is magic. It makes you feel better. It numbs you. Beautiful, magical food deadens your soul just enough so you can't think too hard about anything other than cake or sleep. Putting food on top of it casts a spell to make the feelings go away. You don't have to face yourself or think or be anything other than your brain. No body necessary. Food works. There's the rub. There's the trouble. It works. I would be eating a whole bucket of fried chicken right this very minute if I thought I could still fit into these pants afterward. If I was still okay with being dead inside. The thing is, I'm not. I'm not okay with being dead inside at all. Being numb no longer suits me. It's ill-fitting and I'm antsy about it. I find myself snapping back at people more. Or writing little Bailey-esque rants into my emails when someone's upset me. I don't want to be numb. I want to tell someone who's upset me to take their attitude and shove it right up there. Well, let's just say I'm starting to prefer it to shoving some food in my mouth on top of my hurt feelings. What I have come to call the airplane seatbelt incident of 2014, because I'm a woman who will give anything a title, has made putting food on top of it no longer an option. After the airplane seatbelt incident of 2014, I no longer can deal with being numb. Now numb feels creepy to me. Now numb feels not just dead, but rotting. The food doesn't spackle anymore. It suffocates. And the moment I have this big, beautiful breakthrough that changes my life, I am pissed off. The universe has ruined the comfort of my brownies and my wine by revealing them for what they are, because now I know the truth about them. I feel like someone's just told the 4-year-old me the truth about Santa Claus on Christmas Eve while I'm sitting by the fireplace waiting to hear the jingle bells on the roof. Now all I'm left with are Santa's dumb elves, ill-fitting and antsy. Ill-fitting and antsy are no substitute for big, fat Santa Claus. Now I have to deal with this. Now I have to say no to fatness. Damn it, I want to kick ill-fitting and antsy's asses. Losing weight is not going to be easy. Not once in my life have I ever lost more than 15 pounds unless it involved a serious stomach flu or self-starvation to such an extent that doctors were called. The sheer insanity of how much work it's going to be for me to push through the pain and terror of just beginning is daunting. Once, a close friend Jan, whose name has been changed to protect the innocent, and I checked into a fancy health spa for a week. Calavi is a beautiful, luxurious, but intense place. So intense that they tell you right up front that there is no need to bring anything. After they take your car keys, you are issued gray sweats to wear each day, just like in the military or in prison. Each morning, at the crack of dawn, you are driven up a mountain in a terrifying and painful death run. After that, there are 3 more hours of workouts. Around noon, as you lie on the ground feeling muscles you never knew you had spasm, you whisper elaborate plans of escape for getting over the wall with your fellow prisoners. But just when you summon the energy to make a run for it, you are retrieved by your guide and taken to the spa, where, for the rest of the day, you are pampered with the most luxurious treatments known to humanity. The essence of roses that were grown and nourished with the tears of tiny baby kittens bathes your feet, and you forget all about your plans to escape. Until the next morning, when it starts all over again. 10 minutes after we checked into Calavi, Jan and I went back to the front desk. We had an emergency, we told them. Medical. Personal. Vaginal, our eyebrows implied. They gave us our car keys. We jumped in the car and drove away. I'm not going to talk about what happened out there. I'll never talk about what happened out there. I'm just going to tell you that we arrived back at the spa an hour and a half later, reeking of shame and the grease of fast food drive-thru. We'd panicked. The fear of the oncoming diet was too much. Now, I wait for the panic, but it doesn't come. I am ready. I get a piece of paper and tape it up on the back of my closet door. I climb on a scale. I stare at the number. I let a string of expletives that would make a sailor cry fly out of my mouth. Pen in hand, I walk back over to the paper on the back of the door. I write down the date. I write down my weight. I stare at the number. Then I rip the paper up and throw it in the trash. I don't want to see that number ever again. I gave myself a choice. Which yes did I want to say? There were 2 options. I can say yes, I want to be successful at this. I want to be healthy. I want to live a long life for myself and for my children. I want to feel good. And once I say that, I have to buckle down and do the work and not complain and accept that the work is going to be hard. Because that's what it is. Work. Hard work. But I will be able to buckle my seatbelt on the plane. I won't have narcissistic fears of a karmic plane crash. I won't have a giant coffin and wear a tent for a dress. If I say yes, the life I save will be my own. Or I can say no. Screw losing weight. Screw you, skinny. I can say I do not want to be successful at this. I want to eat the fried chicken. I want to be veal. But if I say no, if I say that I do not want to do the work, then game over. I have to shut up. I don't want to hear me whining ever again about not buckling that plane seatbelt. I don't want to listen to a monologue on the pain of not touching my toes. Do not come crying to me about how I hurt my own feelings when I didn't recognize me in the mirror, because I made a choice. I said no. Wait. I said yes. I said yes to fatness. And if I say yes to fatness, then I need to be fine if I'm rocking size 24s. I need to embrace who I am as I am. I need to buy my own seatbelt extender and pull it out of my purse loud and proud when I get on the plane and dare the idiot next to me to make a comment. The problem with the fatness isn't the fatness. It's me. If I am not going to change, I have to move on. I can't waste precious time hovering in the I wishes and the if onlys. That is being a dreamer. Dreamers never say yes to anything. I have to do. Fat or thin, I have to do. I don't know why I ever thought this was going to be easy. Nothing good is easy. At work, I'm a badass warrior. I'm competitive. I work hard. Hell, I'm a badass competitive warrior at croquet with my kids. I got competitive knitting once. Knitting! Which is why I'm not allowed to knit around other people. Sharp objects, a bloodlust for victory, balls of wool. It's not a good mix. I work hard. That's how I succeed. That's how anyone succeeds. So why in the world did I think weight loss would be any different? Somehow this idea is a light bulb for me. The idea that this is not fun. This is badass warrior work. The idea that I'm never going to enjoy losing weight. That I'm always going to want the fried chicken. Always. Forever. I will always prefer curling up on the sofa with a book to running on a treadmill. For the rest of my life, my blood will pump a little faster at the scent of dark chocolate and bacon mixed together. Cheesecake will always taste like love. Oh, I am never going to like losing weight. Losing weight is not fun. It will never be fun. It will bring me no joy. It will kick my ass and stomp me to the ground. Somehow this knowledge makes me feel so much better. The beauty of lowered expectations. Once I stopped expecting to like it, once I stopped demanding that losing weight be easy or pleasant, once I stopped waiting for the band to start playing, paying attention to what went into my mouth became tolerable. Because I wasn't waiting for it to get better. It's never going to get better. It just sucks. I said yes to losing weight on March 8th, 2014. When I stepped on the scale on March 1st, 2015, I had lost almost 100 pounds. As I write this in the summer of 2015, I've lost more. Unexpectedly more. Then again, anything over 15 pounds was unexpected. More than a few pounds. Unexpectedly more. But saying yes is a powerful thing. Now, I've told you how hard it was, how much I hated it, and how I did it anyway. And still, reader friend, someone among you is going to ask the question anyway. Someone among you is going to ask, Shonda, what diet did you go on? What program did you use? Did I not just say it was never going to be easy, never going to be quick? If things were easy or quick, would there be anyone left out there who talked about struggling with their weight? Now, I'm betting all of those big-time programs you see advertised and recommended by your doctor work. But only if you decide that you are going to do the work to make the programs work. Meaning, nothing works if you don't actually decide that you are really and truly ready to do it. Are you ready? Here's how you know if you are ready or not. 3 years ago, if someone had said something to me like, nothing works until you are really ready for it to work, I would have force-fed them butter until they weighed 1,000 pounds. Because that sounds like crap. Everything sounds like crap until you are in the right mindset. Everything sounds like crap while you are still busy listing reasons you should get to eat that whole cake. You should get to eat that whole cake. Yes, you should. And you can. You can eat that whole delicious cake. You just have to accept that it will make your belly fat. And that is okay. But then do not complain about having a fat belly. Stop berating and shaming and hiding yourself. Become one with your fat belly and love your body for all its gifts. Spend your valuable years on this planet thinking about something other than your weight. Now, moving on to, but Shonda, what diet did you go on? What program did you use? Fine. I did not go on any specific diet or use any specific program. and I did not have any kind of weight loss surgery. But I will tell you what I did. And I am not a professional of any kind except a fake TV doctor writer. So remember that I know absolutely nothing about weight loss because I'm a writer, which means I highly recommend you do the very first thing I did, which is one, start by seeing a licensed physician. I went to my doctor and I said, I don't want to be fat anymore. Help me. My doctor literally applauded me. Eva's cool that way. I asked for and got a complete physical. I did this so I knew where I was starting out because I wanted to know what I was working with. I wanted to be able to see progress in even the smallest ways. I also did whatever my doctor told me to do. After that, number two, I thought about exercise. I promised myself that I would never do any exercise that I did not like. So, I didn't. In the beginning, I didn't exercise at all. I was too busy trying to convince myself not to eat everything I could get my hands on. But when I was ready, I called a trainer. I'd worked with Jeanette Jenkins before. Well, I'd mostly complained and wheezed while she tried to get me to move my body. Now I was ready to do what I was told. Jeanette got me doing Pilates, and I loved it. I mean, who wouldn't? It's exercise you do lying down. For real. It's like the universe finally decided to cut me some slack. Okay, it's also really hard, but still, you lie there. Number three. I made myself drink 64 ounces of water every day, which is just a lot of water, but it made my skin look fantastic. Number four, I decided, and this was the most important rule for me, that no food was off limits. I could eat anything I wanted, as long as I ate a reasonable portion. Also, and this is the hardest part of this important rule, I could only eat exactly what I was craving. Try doing that for a day. I'd been so used to eating simply because it was breakfast time or lunch time or dinner time. I'd never stopped to think about whether or not I was hungry, let alone craving anything. I'd never actually listened to my body before. I know a phrase like listening to your body sounds suspect, like synergy, but it works. The actors on my shows seemed to know what I was doing before almost anyone else. Perhaps because as actors, their bodies are their work instruments. Because they are stared at all day, because they must be so physically present, they could tell instantly that something had changed for me. They got it, and they seemed to understand instinctively how hard going my weight loss was. They were all over me with support. Katie Lowes, Scott Foley, Kerry Washington, and Ellen Pompeo in particular felt like my weekly cheerleaders. Every time I saw one of them at table reads, they had some encouraging word or a hug. As I began to make progress, Ellen told me sternly, "Be careful. Do not lose the booty, lady." "Not possible, Els." As I started to really lose weight, something interesting started to happen. I stopped thinking of my body as a mere container for my brain. I became more aware of it in every way. How it worked, how it felt, how it moved. I noticed how the muscles in my back tightened up in response to stress. I stretched more often. This is going to sound weird, but I became obsessed with my skin and making it perfectly smooth and soft. This meant a lot of moisturizing of knees and feet and hands before bed. And I started to feel strong, like truly strong. When I power pose now, I didn't just feel confident like Wonder Woman. I felt like Wonder Woman. 50 pounds in, I put my daughter Emerson on my back and galloped up and down the halls of our house with her hanging onto my shoulders and squealing. After I put her down for her nap, I sat down on the steps and burst into tears. 4 months ago, there was no way I would have been able to haul myself down the hall even once with a child on my back. Not even a brisk walk. A gallop would have almost killed me. Now, I wasn't even winded. For the first time in my life, the woman who had to be dressed like a child and told to stand still to wait for Oprah began to care about clothes. Dana Asher had been my stylist for years. But dressing me for events had always been like dressing a fat mannequin. I had no opinions, I just wore the clothes. I didn't give a crap what she put on me as long as I felt invisible. Not that it mattered. The variety of clothing choices for plus-size women had always been sparse. It was depressing. Now, I had the opposite problem. I had my pick of designers. The choices were endless, overwhelming. but I had never shopped in the non-plus-size section of the store before. I felt awkward. I had no sense of what looked good on this new body I was now settling into. Dana literally cleared out my closets. Everything I owned, down to my undies, no longer fit. The good stuff went to charity. I managed to hang on to all of my Grey's Anatomy t-shirts. They swam on me, but I wasn't letting them go. Not much else remained. We started over. Dana taught me how to dress, introduced me to colors I'd never considered, coaxed me into form-fitting clothes. I got to know designers. Nothing I wore made me feel invisible. Inside this body, I now felt okay about being seen. By men. I'd been seen before, but I wasn't paying attention to it. I was in the pantry. I was writing. I was busy hiding. And lately, I was too busy protecting myself from what had been happening to my life. Slowly, I am coming to realize that is part of it. The shyness, the introversion, the layers of fat. I'm a quiet, nerdy writer who seemingly overnight became, well, famous. Being famous, even if you are an actor, is considered the toll you pay for getting to do your job at the highest level. For a writer? The unexpected shock of it was shocking and a little bit terrifying. Most writers do not set out to become famous. They set out to sit alone in their pajamas in the back of the pantry and dream. They set out to tell stories. They set out to create worlds. That is who they are. That is who I am. Was. And then lightning struck in the craziest, most amazing way. And people began to know my name and recognize my face. And with that comes a lot of attention from all kinds of places. From people who never looked in my direction. Now they were all looking in my direction. And they were smiling and being nice and offering me things. I didn't want to be looked at. I didn't feel okay being seen. I just wanted to write and hang out with the same friends I've always had and be left alone. How do you accomplish that in this town? Your body becomes a container for your brain. It was a damned good security system. Now, though, I am seen, and I am getting comfortable being seen. I'm getting used to being seen. I'm realizing that there's a part of me that wants to be seen, and that it's okay to want to be seen. That it's okay to want to be seen. It's okay to like being seen. I'm being seen. When I walk past a mirror, it still happens. I catch a glimpse and I think, who is that? The girl in the mirror is a size she hasn't been since she was 16 years old. And she looks younger, like her genetic lottery ticket just won a second time around. But it's me. I'm seeing me. And I like what I see there. That girl looks happy. All it took was the right kind of yes. And salad. Oh yeah, it turns out Betsy was right. It does help to train yourself to love salads. I hate it when she's right. Chapter 9, Yes to Joining the Club. About a year into my year of yes, Chris number one calls to tell me that I'm being awarded the Hollywood Reporter's Sherry Lansing Award at the annual Women in Entertainment Breakfast. He keeps his tone soothingly soft, the mellow tones of a psychiatric nurse, as he informs me that I will have to give a speech. Then he waits for me to freak out. This speech is not your average speech. The Dartmouth commencement was a big deal, yes, but this is not a crowd of Dartmouth graduates looking to the future, looking for wisdom. This is not a gaggle of hopeful and happy parents just thrilled that they are done paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition. It's right in the title. The speech is for women in entertainment. These are powerful women in entertainment. You know how I know this? The Hollywood Reporter releases a list to go with this event. It's called the Power 100. Some of the women who will be in that room listening to my speech are legends. Sherry Lansing herself will be in that room. Chris waits for me to start yelling. He waits for Chicken Bone, Janet Jackson boob fierce not hollering in his ear. I'm quiet a long moment, then.